Good afternoon, everybody, and thanks a lot to the organizers for the invitation. I really appreciate it. Very nice meeting. So today I'm going to talk about a subject which is in principle quite old, namely the two-dimensional Heisenberg antiferromagnet, you know, the model and also experiment. So this has been something, you know, studied, you know, for a long time, but there are new experiments and hopefully some new theoretical insights as well, and computational, which is my main focus here. So the issue is basically, if you take a 2D antiferromagnet spin half, we normally think of the excitations as spin waves. Spin wave theory is supposed to describe these systems quite well. But there have been proposals over the year that actually, in at least in some parts of the Brillouin zone, in particular at high energy, the magnons could actually break up into what's called spinons, so two objects carrying spin one half. So what I will try to convince you is that that doesn't quite happen in the Heisenberg magnet and in the experiments considered, but that we are very close to that happening. So this is ongoing work. We are just finalizing the paper now, together with these people mentioned here. So the main hard work has been done by who's a postdoc. She's sharing her time between BU and Computational Science Research Center in Beijing. It's a relatively new big center in Beijing, and also Yan-Chi Chin, who is a PhD student, soon finishing up his thesis at IOP in Beijing. Sylvain Caponi is currently at BU on sabbatical. Normally he's stationed at the University of Toulouse. Oh, here's his picture. And Stefano Cesi, he's a faculty member at the CSRC. And finally, Zhuyang Meng, who is an assistant professor at the IOP as well. Okay, so let me do a quick review here of what we're going to talk about. The spin one half Heisenberg model, you can consider that model on any lattice you like. The simplest case maybe would be a one-dimensional chain with nearest neighbor interactions. Today the focus will be on the 2D square lattice, but I will say a few words about the 1D case as well. So in one dimension, we know that the system is in the ground state is critical, so there's no long-range order. But in two dimensions, we have a long-range order, although the ordered moment is heavily reduced by quantum fluctuations. So if we look at the excitations, we know, because there's even an exact solution, that the excitations can be classified as spinons which carry spin one half. Whereas in two dimensions, as I already mentioned, the conventional wisdom is that the excitations are spin waves and they essentially carry a quantum number Sz equals one. So we have broken the symmetry, so the total spin is no longer conserved, but the Sz is conserved. So that's a conventional wisdom, but again, there have been proposals that actually in some part of the Brillouin zone, these spin waves or magnons could perhaps break up into some object similar to what we see in one dimension. So in this talk, I will talk about the experimentally relevant quantity here, the dynamic structure factor that is measured, for example, in neutron scattering, and it's also measured in NMR, as we heard about before lunch. But I will focus on neutron scattering today. So, in addition to the 2D Heisenberg model, I will also talk about what we call the JQ model, which is a model in which we can study what happens when we reduce the antiferromagnetic order and eventually destroy it. That will give us some insights, it turns out, about the Heisenberg model itself. So I will talk about mainly initially numerical results that we obtain using quantum Monte Carlo simulations, and quantum Monte Carlo simulations we cannot do in real time. We have to study the system in imaginary time and do a numerical analytic continuation to get the real frequency dynamic properties. I will say a few words about how we do that. And then I will compare results with experiments as well as with some previous calculations. And finally, I will present a theory of spinon-magnon mixing, which can, we believe, explain what's going on in terms of possible spinon deconfinement in this kind of system. Let me quickly remind you about spinons in one dimension. So if we take an icing picture, so let's assume that we have some sort of quantum icing model which has antiferromagnetic long-range order, like this, and then we flip one spin. So we flip this red spin here and go to this picture here. And that could, for example, be done by a neutron coming in and hitting the system. So now you see the energy has increased, and it has increased because we have two bonds where we don't have antiferromagnetic alignment here. But now, because of some spin fluctuations in the system, you know, pairs of spins can flip without any additional energy cost. And that means that these defects here, they actually separate. So now you can see that these are actually domain walls in the system. And those are what we would call spinons. But this is, of course, an icing-like picture where we have broken the symmetry, which we know that we really don't do in one dimension. One can also look at this from another perspective, where we don't really break the spin symmetry. Instead, we break translational invariance by forming valence bonds. So these represent singlets here. So this system has what we call valence bond solid order. And here you can also excite the system. You can break one of these singlets, forming a triplet, for example, an SZ equals one state. And again, because of quantum fluctuations, these unpaired spins can now separate, and these are the spinons in that kind of phase. Okay? So these pictures look quite different, but in either case, you can see that we can talk about spinons. And it turns out that the Heisenberg chain itself is sort of something in between these pictures. The ground state is critical, so it has actually aspects of both of these, and we know exactly from the Bethe-Ansatz that one can classify the excitations as spinons, which correspond to critical domain walls in the system. So now if we try this in two dimensions, you can imagine that in two dimensions you take, antiferromagnetic orientations also for neighboring chains, which I don't indicate here, but you just have to imagine it. So then if we try to separate these chain domain walls here, it would actually cause some mismatches with the neighboring chains, and that would cost an energy. You get what's called the confining string, which keeps these spinons together. So we cannot get deconfinement in this simple, naive picture in two dimensions. Something similar would happen if we do like this. You would get some mismatch of this valence bond ordering with the neighboring chains. So the simple picture suggests that there's no deconfinement of these fractionalized excitations in 2D. But the question is this always correct? Because again, the pictures are very naive, and they may be misleading. So let me connect a bit to experiments here, show some well-known experimental results. So there are lots of experiments showing these spinons being real in quasi-1D systems. So this is from a paper by Bella Lake and collaborators on this, one of the prototypical quasi-1D systems. So here you don't really see that there are chains forming here. The chains form actually in the Z direction here, but it's because the orbitals are not indicated here. So there's some anisotropic bonding going on, so that in fact you have a copper chain. So these red ones are the coppers, and they carry spin 1/2. And this is a very nice weakly coupled spin chain system. And experimentally, the neutron scattering cross section, which is this dynamic, well, it's proportional to this dynamic spin structure factor at momentum transfer K and energy transfer omega. And this is taken at very low temperature, much less than the in-chain coupling J. And you can see this is the kind of scattering intensity you get, and it compares really well with beta on such calculations. So this is basically confirming the spin-on excitations in one dimension. And there are many other experiments as well. Like, right, so let's move to two dimensions. Let me remind you what spin wave theory is. So let's look at this bond interaction, which is the Heisenberg exchange. It has X, Y, and Z components. We can write the X and Y components in terms of these ladder operators here, and you can do this for any spin value, and then we are interested in spin 1/2, but in spin wave theory, you imagine that you start from infinite S when the system just becomes classical, so then you just minimize the energy corresponding to the diagonal term here, so this will be the classical state of minimal energy. And then you describe the deviations from that in terms of bosons. So if you flip a spin, that corresponds to adding a boson here. And if you have high spin, you can have you know, many bosons, because these flips can occur in, you know, many steps. You go from fully up to fully down, but here I just indicate it for a spin 1/2 system. So then you write down you know, this bosonic theory, using the mapping between spin operators and boson operators. And in the end, at least if you do the lowest order in 1 over S, you get a very simple Hamiltonian. If you go to higher orders, it becomes quickly much more complicated. But the lowest order, you just get these non-interacting spin waves. So you just can have any, so these are the number operators counting how many spin waves of type alpha and beta you have for each momentum, and the dispersion relation comes out quite clearly as well. You can then also calculate what is the actual reduction of the mean order parameter due to these bosons that you have, and you get some expression that you can evaluate. And if you put in S equals 1/2, you can of course ask, well, does this really work for spin 1/2, because it's an expansion in 1 over S, and you know, that 1 over S is 2, so that appears to be far from the limit where we should expect it to be valid. But nevertheless, you get a number, you know, out, which is 0.3034 if you go to leading order, and people have pushed it to higher orders, and you get around 0.307 if you go there. So then you can ask, and people ask that, you know, already some time ago, of course, is this really correct? Because again, for S 1/2, maybe we shouldn't expect it to work. So let me just show you why we know that it works, although you may still discuss why it works, but we can calculate a lot of things using quantum Monte Carlo calculations. So for example, we can calculate the order parameter, which is the staggered magnetization of the system, averaged over, you know, the whole system, which we take as a finite system of n spins. And then if we do this numerically and we want to check what happens in the thermodynamic limit, then normally we compute the square of this order parameter, and we will see, you know, what is its value when n goes to infinity. So these Monte Carlo methods that we use, they are again done for finite size. They involve no approximations for a given system size, but we have to extrapolate to infinite size. So this was already done for this system more than, well, I guess almost 30 years ago by Joseph Reger and Peter Young. And they got this value 0.3 with a pretty large error bar, so between 0.28 and 0.32, but that was already taken as proof that you have long-range order, and as you recall from the previous graph, this value is also pretty close to what even the linear spin wave theory gets, just to show what we can get these days with more powerful algorithms and way more powerful computers as well, of course. Here I show explicitly how we do extrapolations in 1 over the system length, so we can calculate the squared order parameter as I describe here, or we can look at some long distance correlation function And in either case, we can extrapolate in 1 over L, and we get the squared order parameter here, which when we take the square root, gives this. And this is very close to what people get for high-order spin wave theory. So it seems like spin wave theory, even a little bit mysteriously, describes the ground state very well, even for spin 1/2. Okay, but how about if we go to excitations? So people have also calculated the dispersion relation of the spin waves, which I showed you the expression for to leading order before. That was this black line here. So this is along some particular path in the Brillouin zone. And you can see when we go from the linear order to including 1 over S corrections, the dispersion goes up quite a lot, but it's basically, or it really is just by a constant factor. And then when one goes to even higher orders, you start to get some non-constant behavior here along the line where it was constant in linear order. But, there's not that much happening there. But other calculations have also been done, and those are shown in this graph as well. So this graph is from this recent paper where Syromyatnikov actually did this 1 over S cubed calculation, which is very involved. So this graph is from his paper. So the paper also shows these open dots here, which are from this 2005 paper. It's from a series expansion around the Ising limit. So in principle, that should be a more reliable calculation. And you see that it deviates quite a lot. Or, depending on your point of view, you may see, well, okay, it deviates a little bit, but it doesn't seem to be that serious. We also did, with Radeep Singh, something a bit similar to what I will talk about today, but we have increased the level of sophistication quite a bit now, so we can say a bit more. But already at this point, we got the energy here agreed quite well with the series expansion, so we can really trust these values because they agree well. So now the point is that, again, that this disagreement here, you may say it's just, let's say, 10 or even maybe less percent reduction in the excitation energy at that momentum. So what's the big deal? But the thing is, it really looks like the spin wave calculation is converging to something different there. Or maybe it's just converging extremely slowly to the correct value. Nobody really knows. The spin wave expansion may, as you probably know, be an asymptotic series, not a convergent series. So then, but this has intrigued people for a long time because it may be a hint of something else going on around this wave number pi zero. Maybe there are actually some other excitations or coexistence of magnons and spinons, whatever. So there has been over the years a lot of work trying to figure out what's going on there. So there was also experimentally, there have been many papers. There are lots of materials that are quasi 2D antiferromagnet. Maybe the best of them is this one, which I will not try to pronounce. It has some abbreviation too, which I forget now, CDTS something. But anyway, it's weakly coupled layers of spin 1/2, square lattice, and the coupling between the layers is way smaller than it is inside the layers. So this is the kind of neutron scattering intensity reported in this paper. And you can see from the title that they actually claim here that the excitations around here, around pi zero, are actually deconfined spinons. So they are no longer magnons at all. So here it looks like I have a very small scattering intensity, and here as well. They claim the fractionalization here, not here, which is also what some previous works had speculated. I think here the color plot is a little bit misleading because it looks like there's almost no scattering intensity there, but actually, as you will see in the next slide, there is still quite a lot. It's just mainly how you pick the color scale here. So maybe it's less here, but there is still something. So if you look at those particular momenta, this is again from that same paper. if you just look at the fixed momentum pi 0 and pi over 2 pi over 2, and you look at the frequency dependence of the energy transfer in the experiment, and again, these are at very low temperature, so you can take them essentially as zero temperature experiments. So you see here that there's some profile here, and it's different at pi 0 and pi over 2 pi over 2, and they did actually polarize neutrons, so you can separate longitudinal and transversal components. So the transversal would correspond to the spin wave, and longitudinal would be due to amplitude fluctuations of the order parameter. And then they tried to extract the continua here. They fitted some delta function, which is supposed to correspond to the magnon. And then they are left with some continua, and they talk about those. And then they claim from these data and from some variational wave function studies that these excitations here are due to spinons, while these here are due to magnons. So I will not talk about in detail what they did, other than to say that they used an RVB type wave function with some projection and so on. So pictorially, you can think of it as the system, the wave function has some singlets and some unpaired spins. So in the ground state, there would be only singlets, but when you go to spin one excitation, you have some unpaired spins, and the claim was that if you go and give this state momentum pi zero, these unpaired spins actually fly away from each other, and that would mean that you have deconfined spinons, whereas at other momenta, for example, this here, they will stay bound. Okay? So, based on this, they also tried to reproduce these data here, and they show results in the paper. Let me not show it here, but they match pretty well. But a potential problem here is that this wave function that they looked at is really a spin liquid. Yes, please. Well, okay, so this is the confusing thing, in my opinion, about this paper, because clearly they fit a Gaussian here, which you would expect maybe to be something that is actually a delta function and something very narrow, and this is some experimental broadening. And I will discuss this at length later, but I would say that should be due to the magnon. But they somehow seem to not discuss that so much, but they mainly discuss these continua and compare with what they get from here. So that part of the paper is a bit confusing, and it's a key question, in fact. So this wave function that they use is in fact a spin liquid, so it wouldn't, produce the magnon there anyway. It wouldn't produce a sharp peak. So let me now turn to what we are actually doing. So we do, again, quantum Monte Carlo calculations, and we look at imaginary time correlations, and from those we try to obtain the real frequency spectrum. So it's very hard to do anything in real time, real frequency, in these kinds of systems, but we can do quite well in imaginary time. So we calculate for some generic operator, we compute this time-dependent correlation function that I call g of tau. So this is how the time dependence is defined in imaginary time. In real time, we would have some i's there, some complex factors. So for example, if we talk about neutron scattering, your operator would just be the z component or the x or y component of the spin operator, Fourier transformed at momentum q. So that will give you s of q and omega if you analytically continue this. So the relationship, which is the analytic, what we use in the analytic continuation, is that this correlation function is something that looks like a Laplace transform of the spectral function that we want. So if we are at zero temperature, this would really be a Laplace transform going from zero to infinity here, but at finite temperature, in principle, there's some negative weight. So now we need to invert that. So if we know S, it's of course easy to get G we can just integrate, but now we have the opposite situation that we know G and we would like to extract S. And that's a very difficult inverse problem in general. In the calculations, we compute G of tau on some grid of tau points, and we have statistical errors for those G of taus. So we have incomplete information, and then it's known that this kind of inverse is not really even unique. So you cannot specify uniquely ness of omega given your noisy data. Of course, the better the data is, meaning the smaller the noise is, the less non-unique is it. But this is very difficult in general. So this is known as the numerical analytic continuation problem. So just to be a bit concrete here, what we have from our simulation that may be something like this. So we have some tau points, and here you see I don't even have a uniform grid. It doesn't have to. This is almost a quadratic grid, something like that. Not exactly, but the spacing is increasing. And these are the values, and these are the error bars. And these error bars look extremely small, right? But you can see when you go to longer times, the relative errors become pretty big, and this is very it's very difficult still to do the numerical analytic continuation with that kind of error bars. So what the way we do it is, we have to, let's say just for the purpose of discussion here, let's say that we guess S of omega. We just write down some spectrum and then we see what G of tau that corresponds to. And then we have to compare that with our computed data. And then, as you always do in data fitting, we can characterize the distance between our guess, which led to that one, and the real one, or let's say the QMC computed one. We can characterize that by chi squared. So it's the sum of deviations squared divided by the error bars squared. Okay, so now in this case, it's even a little bit worse because we get these data points from the same simulation, so that actually means that the errors are also correlated. So strictly speaking, and we always do, we have to use the covariance matrix. So these standard deviations here, or the variances, are just the diagonal elements of a covariance matrix that characterizes the covariance between different data points. But in any case, we have some way of characterizing how close our guess gets us to our data. So the simplest way to do the analytic continuation this way would be function fitting. So let's say you just have some reason to believe that the spectral function has some form, and maybe the form has a few parameters. Now you can just adjust those to minimize chi squared. So as an example of that, I show here some results I got with Rajiv Singh some years ago. I already mentioned that when we looked at these spin wave dispersions. So here, we looked at the 2D Heisenberg model, and we actually, in this case, we were able to separate the longitudinal and transversal parts. So we calculated different correlation functions for longitudinal and transversal, and we were able to do that by putting a weak staggered field to break the symmetry of the system. So we chose an axis along which the system is ordered, and then we calculate correlation functions longitudinal and transversal to that direction. And then we did function fitting. I don't tell you here exactly what the functional form was, but you can see here are the results. So the solid lines are for the transversal component, where we actually built in a delta function, because if we have magnons, we expect that there should be a delta function or an extremely narrow peak, perhaps. So we built that in our functional form, and then we just modeled the continuum that you expect because of spin wave interactions. We modeled that by just a Gaussian, a truncated Gaussian that could not go below the magnon peak. And then we used some other suitable form for the longitudinal part, which is shown here. Okay, so here the height of this peak here just corresponds to the relative weight of the delta function in the total, or in that part of the spectral weight. So it's like 60% of the transversal part is in the spin wave, single spin wave contribution. And then we get a slightly different behavior at pi over 2, pi over 2, and the insets show what we get when we combine them, which would correspond to what you get for the total neutron scattering cross-section if you don't polarize the neutrons, or if you just do the averaging based on your polarized data. So similar to what I showed you before for the experimental data, and you can see that it does look a little bit similar to that, but the experiments, of course, have some additional broadening. I will compare later on with our new data a little bit more. So that's what we did with function fitting. But here, of course, we did assume some particular functional form, so it's clear that this is not completely unbiased. It must be to some extent affected by the particular form that we chose to optimize. So if we don't want to make any assumptions like that, we would have to do something else. And then what what people normally do is to parameterize the spectrum as a sum of a large number of delta functions on a uniform grid, for example. So then the adjustable parameters are just the amplitudes of the delta functions, and you can represent that by something like a histogram like that. And if you have enough of these delta functions, you, for all practical purposes, you get a continuous function. Okay. So then the problem is to optimize all those parameters. But in this case, unlike the previous case, you have lots of parameters. You may have hundreds or thousands of them. And then you run into this uniqueness problem. You will find very quickly that when you try to optimize them, you will get some very noisy looking spectra. And many of them, although they look quite different, may be equally good in the sense of chi-squared. So it has been known for a long time that simple chi-squared fitting here doesn't really work. You get completely crazy-looking spectra. Although you do get the spectral weight typically at least in the correct region, but it looks very noisy. So it has been clear for a long time that you need some way to regularize or smoothen these spectra. And how to do that is the big problem or big issue. So the standard way is to use the so-called maximum entropy method, where you define an entropy for these spectra with respect to some sort of default model, meaning, let's say, something that you have guessed or gotten from some other calculation or something like that, or it could just be a flat behavior up to some frequency. So then what you try to do is to get spectra that have a good chi squared, but also a high entropy. And high entropy will actually mean that the spectra are smooth. So there's a balance between those two. And if you do it right, it works quite well if the spectrum is not too complicated, or if it doesn't have any really sharp features. So for example, some spectrum like that, you know, you could get quite easily, but if you have a delta function and some background, it would not really give you a delta function. So the alternative approach that we are using goes under the name of stochastic analytic continuation. So there are several papers on those kinds of approaches, and we have some new aspects that some of which I will talk about today. So basically what we do, we treat, I should have repeated this picture, I guess. We treat the spectra basically as configurations of a statistical mechanics problem. So you can think of these AIs here as being your, making up your configuration space. For example, similar to what you would have in a, I don't know, what we should take, some Ising model or some model of a gas or a liquid where you have positions of molecules or atoms. Here instead we just have amplitudes of these delta functions, And now we introduce a fictitious temperature that we call theta, and we treat chi squared as an energy, or let's say chi squared divided by 2, we treat as an energy. And then we say that the probability, you know, given our Monte Carlo data, the probability of a given spectrum parameterized in some way looks like a Boltzmann probability. Okay. So then we get smoothness because we will sample these configurations and take averages over a large number of spectra. So that gives us smoothness. But then you can imagine here there's an issue how to choose this fictitious sampling temperature, which has nothing to do with the real temperature of the system. And there are several proposals for that, and it's similar to the maximum entropy method in the sense that we have to now balance, good fits, meaning getting low average values of chi squared with the danger of overfitting the data, meaning if we go to really low temperature, we are basically back to just finding, some really spectra that really fit very well, but as we saw before, those will be very noisy. So one has to choose the temperature in some way which gives a good balance. There are many proposals. We have some new proposal for that, which is very simple and motivated by really by just statistics. But let me not talk about that because it gets a bit technical how we exactly do that. But the point is that we get a smooth average this way. So in our new way of dealing with this, we also introduce a new parameterization of the spectrum, which has, at first sight may look a little bit crazy. So we use a number of delta functions shown here. This would be the spectrum as a function of frequency. But we don't put them on a fixed grid. They float around in the continuum, and they all have the same height, the same amplitude. So then what we do, we imagine that we have a histogram here, and then we collect hits in the histogram. We just count how many of these delta functions that fall within a given histogram bin. And since these move around, that will fluctuate, and we will take averages. And in the end, we get a nice-looking spectrum. When we sample again with that probability at some temperature that we believe is good. Now, what will be very important in what I'm talking about here today is that even in this case, we cannot resolve very sharp features. So you can, if you think about statistical mechanics, you will know that there is some entropy of this spectrum and or of the this system that will tend to spread out, the spectrum. Because there are many more configurations that are spread out than have, let's say many of these concentrated in some small region. So configurational entropy will put a pressure toward a smooth spectrum. Now, if we are modeling these magnons in spin systems, we pretty much know that we will have a big delta function, or maybe a small one, but nevertheless a delta function at the lower edge of the spectrum. So now we build that in. So we say, okay, out of all these delta functions, I treat the lowest one in a special way. I will optimize its amplitude. And these other ones, I will just sample exactly as before, but they cannot go below, the first one here. Okay, and then we have some way of optimizing the amplitude of the first one. We will not decide where it should be. It will still fluctuate around. But the amplitude is optimized. And again, I'm sorry, I don't have time to exactly talk about how we optimize it, but I will show some tests to convince you that it works. Okay, so to test, we can use some known cases, but there are actually not that many good cases where we know what the spectrum should look like exactly. So we can make synthetic data, meaning I can just construct a spectrum, for example, this one. Here I have a delta function that contains 1/3 of the weight, and I have a Gaussian. So now I can just do, you know, from that spectrum, I can just calculate the corresponding d of tau. And then I can put some noise into that d of tau of, you know, whatever magnitude I like. And I would like to, you know, put noise, a noise level similar to what we see in UMC calculations, of course. And then I want to see if the method can reproduce. Okay, so if I just do it, you know, with these many delta functions without treating one of them in a special way, this is what you get at this noise level. So you can think of that as the error bar if I have normalized my g of tau to 1 at tau equals 0. So you see that I do get a reasonably sharp peak here, and I do get something which looks close to that other bump there. But clearly there's a lot of broadening here. If I improve the quality of my data, meaning I go to a smaller noise level, this peak would gradually get narrower and taller, and this would gradually reproduce the correct form better and better. But this is pretty much what you get in QMC calculations. Actually, you can do a little bit better in QMC. But here I took a case which was not extremely good in that sense. Okay, so this was expected. We didn't expect to, you know, really resolve a delta function. But then the point is, if we actually go to this parameterization where we say, okay, we know, or we hypothesize that there should be a delta function at the lower edge, we optimize its weight in the way that I don't tell you, but you will be able to read about it soon once we finish the paper. Or, of course, I can tell you in private after, those of you who may be interested. When we do that, we get something which is essentially perfect. So I forget exactly what weight we got in this main peak. Now, it should be 1/3, but maybe we got 0.32 or 0.33. I forget exactly, but very close. And you can see that it must be very close, because the second bump here is reproduced almost perfectly. So it has the correct weight and shape and everything. So the correct weight must in the delta function must also be reproduced. So this worked really well. But this case is in some sense a little bit simpler than what we are dealing with in the actual S of Q and omega problem, because there's a big or reasonably big gap between these two features. So then it's always easy sort of to isolate the features of the delta function if you sort of know that you have it. So a more challenging case would be if that second bump actually touches the delta function. So that's what I want to show you next. So then I put a delta function at the frequency, at 0.4. And this is actually wrong. This should be, these are switched. It should be that the frequency is at 1 and the weight in the delta function is 0.4. Okay, so this is then what we get. And this is for two different noise levels. This black curve here is what we try to reproduce. The blue and red are two different realizations of noise that I put into the data. So you see that it's pretty good. We get the correct weight in the peak to within, let's say, 5%. And the shape of the continuum is pretty good, except really close to the peak. If we improve the noise level to 10 to the minus 6, and this is actually still achievable with QMC if you burn enough CPU time. Yes, of course, right. So this is a sort of realistic thing to achieve. And you see that it worked quite well. Okay, so after this introduction to the technicalities, let's now see what we get for the 2D Heisenberg model. So here I show four cases. So this one is close to Q equals 0. K is 2 pi over L here. I should have said that here. These are the two wave vectors we looked at before, and this is one close to pi pi. So we always, for any Q, we still find that there's a magnon pole, there's a delta function. If we compare with our old results, which had were based on that functional form fitting, we should compare this one with that one. The amplitude in the delta function here is about 40%. Before we got, let's say, 45, 46%. The continuums look a little bit different, but you know, not too different. Here the differences are a bit larger, but still similar weight in the magnon pole, and the shape of the continuum is a little bit better. I would trust this more because this again was probably biased by the particular functional form that we used. So plotting in a way that experimentalists normally do, we use this color coding. Here we just put the lower bound, which you can think of as the magnon dispersion in one as white here. We also put an upper bound corresponding to 95% of the weight for given momentum being between these lines. And that can be compared with the experiment, but it's not easy to compare with these color coding, so we will do something else. We do need to worry about finite size effect as well. We also did Lanczos calculations, meaning exact diagonalization for very small systems, and we did the QMC up to L equals 48. That's N equals 48 squared. And then we have to extrapolate and see what it does. So let me not talk about it too much other than saying that it seems like at L equals 48, we are pretty much converged. So we don't worry about finite size effects after L equals 48. So now let's compare our results with neutron scattering, and again, the same paper as I showed you before. So this graph shows the experimental dispersion along this path in the Brillouin zone as blue, the linear spin wave theory in black, and our results in red. And here we haven't adjusted anything because the experiments already had normalized by J for us. This is just taking what we get and putting it together with their result. And you can see that it agrees quite well. Now, the agreement is really quite remarkable, I would say, when we look at the profiles at these two momenta that we are mainly interested in. Here, what we did to compare was we have to broaden our result. Okay, we have the delta function and the continuum. We do a Gaussian convolution so that we match the experimental data. And we have to adjust a common amplitude because the neutron scattering result is just given in some arbitrary unit depending on how many hours they count statistics, I guess. But you can see that the agreement is quite well, it's really good. So we use the same broadening here and here and the same amplitude adjustment here and here. So really agrees quite well. So based on this, we would say, because in our calculation we have the delta function there for all Q, we would say, okay, the excitations are really magnons. But then we are asking the question, could spin-ons still be important here? Mainly, you know, this big continuum there, could it still have something to do with spin-ons? Because again, spin wave theory doesn't really convert well at pi zero. So now to address that, I go to another model, which we call the JQ model, and this is something I talked about at the colloquium yesterday. Now I will just very quickly introduce what this is. So there's this theory of deconfined criticality, which describes the phase transition between an antiferromagnet and a valence bond solid. And according to this theory, that's a continuous transition, and it's very interesting, and I talked about that yesterday. I will not talk about it today. But I will use the same model as we have used to test this theory. So that model we call the JQ model. So it's made up of Heisenberg nearest neighbor interactions, and the nearest neighbor interactions, the exchange you can think of as a singlet projector. This is a singlet projection operator. And now we can take products of singlet projectors. So if we just use these two, we get what we call the JQ model or JQ2 model. So this model, actually, if you make this Q very large, it goes into this kind of valence bond solid phase. If Q is small, it's in this phase. It seems to have this critical point here, and so on. So it's what we call a designer Hamiltonian to study this kind of physics. now we will use this model to, in addition to the Heisenberg results, to see what happens with the spectra as we turn on this Q interaction. So I will do this very quickly. We'll just look at the spectra at these two points and show you some results, what happens as a function of Q over J. So in terms of Q over J, the critical point is very high up at 22, so I will stay in the null phase for now. So let me show you what we get here at these two moments. So let's just focus on pi zero, because that's the important one, and I'm running out of time, I think. So you can see the frequency goes down. We have normalized it in some particular way. We actually know from a previous paper that if we go all the way to the critical point, which is here, we should actually get a gapless excitation at this momentum. So this is still a finite size effect here. If we do finite size scaling at this point, this energy goes to zero. What's more stunning probably is that this amplitude in the delta function, which was 40% in the Heisenberg model, drops very quickly to what appears to be essentially zero. When we do finite size scaling, it actually vanishes here. So that's way before the deconfined critical point. So the interpretation of this is that when we just add a little bit of this other interaction, the magnon pole goes away, and we interpret that as the magnon splits up into two spinons. Okay? But that doesn't happen at pi over two. That stays, the weight in the delta function stays, you know, pretty flat there. So it's only close to pi zero that the magnon splits up into spinons. Okay? So how can it do that? Well, in the remaining, maybe I have 2-3 minutes left. Yeah. Let me talk about what we believe is going on here. So we believe that there's a spin-on-magnon mixing. So if we just look at the linear spin wave dispersion relation, this is the energy as a function of momentum for a spin wave, right? Then we can say, okay, the spinons, let's say that we have spinons, they also have some dispersion relation. And we know that we have deconfined spinons at that special critical point that I didn't talk so much about. But nevertheless, at that critical point, we believe that we have 4 gapless points. So in the antiferromagnet, the magnons are gapless at 0, 0, and pi, pi. But at the deconfined critical point, we get gapless excitations also at 0 pi and pi 0. So to model that, we just, you know, make a dispersion relation which has those 4 gapless points. And then we say that, okay, let me actually go to this figure, maybe it's clearer. If this is some sort of picture of non-interacting spinon and magnon excitation. So the picture is that we have a magnon which has some dispersion. And then higher up in energy, we have a spin-on dispersion. So you can imagine that you add some constant to this thing here, then you get basically this red curve here. And why should you add a constant? Well, because the spin-ons are higher in energy, and you always have to have 2 of them furthermore. So this is just the lower edge of a 2 spin-on continuum that you can have up here. Okay, so now the point is that since you have the low energy spin-ons at pi zero, you can have a situation where these 2 bands almost touch each other there. So if there is some interaction between, or let's say connection between these 2 subspaces, meaning that the magnon can actually split up into 2 spin-ons, and we just model it in a way where it splits up on the nearest neighbor sides, we get a coupling, you know, constant for that, which when we go to momentum space, it has this form. Then when you solve that problem, you will actually find that because the closeness of these things here, if you adjust things in that way, you actually get, if you look at the lowest edge of the spectrum that you actually get in this system, it has that dip at pi zero. Okay, so we believe that that's basically going on, and we can also, with this effective model, calculate what is the amplitude in the lowest at the lowest energy, which again has a delta function in that effective model, And we can compare that with what we get from the QMC. So what we get from the QMC is this red dots with arrow bars. You see that the weight in the Magnum peak is about 40%, close to 50. At other points, it's higher. It goes almost to 1, eventually at 0.0 and 5.5. This effective model, of course, has some parameters that we have to adjust, but it always has this kind of shape as well when where there's a dip close to pi zero, again, because that's where the spinons and magnons mix the most. And this, we believe, corresponds to, in the experiment, this is what I showed you early on. Not much weight is shown here, but actually there is a lot of weight here. It's just that it's spread out because there's less weight in the magnon pole and more in the continuum, and then in the color coding used, you just don't see it very much. So then we can also actually reproduce what happens in the JQ model with this thing. If I go back to this picture here, if we adjust U over J in the JQ model, we believe that it corresponds to just pushing down the spinon dispersion below the magnon here. So then the two spinons would actually have lower energy than the magnon. So that doesn't happen yet in the Heisenberg model, but it appears to happen in the JQ model. So what we have, we believe, is a simple phenomenological model for nearly deconfined spinons. It seems to reproduce quite well the numerics, and the numerics also reproduce the experiment. And I think I will stop there, so thanks a lot.
Okay, very good. So we have time for a few questions. Yes? Yeah, please wait to get the microphone.
So I have a quick question about the construction of spectrum from any continuation. So do you always assume the delta peak is at the lower edge of the spectrum?
Yeah, so we don't have to do that, of course, in the analytic continuation. But in this case, we do assume that. So you know, all calculations that we are aware of for S of Q and omega would say that there's a delta function at the lower edge of the spectrum. In principle, if you go to really, really high orders, for example, in spin wave theory, there should be some tiny, tiny broadening of that delta function, but it's always at the lowest edge. So that's our assumption. In principle, we could relax that condition and let it go up here too, but we haven't done that.
Another quick question about the analytic continuation is that here, when you do stochastic analytic continuation, we have to assume some sort of some form of measure in the space of, say, L square function.
Right.
So what kind of measure do you assume here?
Well, okay, so chi squared itself is just defined in terms of the closeness to the spectrum. So I don't think there's any question of the measure here, but it's true that when we sample the spectrum, we implicitly have chosen some measure. And actually, it turns out that, and this will be discussed in this paper that is in the process of being written, that the parametrization, depending on which one you use, that will affect the shape of the spectrum a little bit, sometimes quite a lot. It depends on how good the data is. And that's because the entropy content of the spectrum will depend on the parameterization. So I think that's the measure you are talking about. So this is really an unsolved question. What is the? Is there some way of showing that you should use some measure instead of some other measure? I think that is actually not known. It turns out that this parameterization here, if you think of the underlying histogram where we collect the hits here, you can easily calculate the entropy of that spectrum, meaning how many ways are there to get a certain number of hits in each histogram bin. You will find that you get basically the same entropy that you get in the MaxEnt method. So if you just use this kind of sampling here without building in the delta function, we get results very similar to the MaxEnt.
It's such a long time ago we write about this sort of thing with you, so I don't remember the details, but you know, oxygen NMR could measure the spectral weight at low energies arising from the damping of all the magnons, and you did Monte Carlo calculations, and I remember Sudeep and his associate did calculations of the damping rate of based on magnon expansion. And qualitatively, their calculations were similar to our results, but at the quantitative level, there's a significant difference.
Right.
Now, when you begin to talk about like spinor-magnon interactions and so on, I wonder if it might affect also at the quantitative level something at low energies.
Right. So I think in the Heisenberg model, I would say no, because after all, you know, what we see in the Heisenberg model is that, you know, these spinons, they affect the behavior at, you know, for the higher energies. And of course, in NMR, you're looking at the low energy spectral weight. So I would think in the Heisenberg model, you know, this spinon, almost deconfined spinons we are talking about, if we go to, you know, low energies, for example, here, the spinons are so tightly bound. I mean, you can think of the magnons still, at least in our model, as fluctuating in and out of the spinon space. But the spinons always stay extremely close to each other, so you should not think of them as deconfined spinons. But just mentioning, as you mentioned, that we are currently also now going back to those things that we looked at long time ago, calculating NMR rates and so on, using these methods that we think are, you know, better than what we had before.
Okay, further questions? Actually, I have what I think is a trivial question. So the neutron measurements did polarization analysis and saw the transverse and longitudinal. I assume you could do the same.
Yeah, that's right. So we and the thing is, we did it. You know, I did it with Rajiv Singh already. You know, a long time ago, where we put a staggered field. So this is what we'd like to get, right? Transverse and longitudinal components. So in this 2001 paper, if I ever find the graph here. Here we did calculate both the longitudinal and transverse, but the thing is, in the calculation, you then have to do basically two calculations. You have to put on a staggered field to actually break the symmetry, and for this recent work now, I guess for some reason, we decided that, okay, let's try to do a really good job for the total spectral weight, and then later we will separate the two again. So the plan is to again do them separately, but we haven't done it yet. Yeah, but we can do it because we have done it in the past. Right.
Okay, well, then please join me.
I think there was one more question.
Oh, sorry, I didn't. Oh, okay, great.
Your JQ model, the fact that you are getting something at a pi zero is because the Q term that you have chosen is along the bond to the bond, Cij, Clk.
Right.
So imagine that I did it, you know, in a diagonal, CIL or CKJ,
right.
Then are you going to get a similar things in along the pi by 2? Because you break the symmetry
of
the lattice.
That's a good question. So, you know, one could imagine that, but I'm not sure, because in this deconfined criticality, you basically have two, you know, here I illustrate a columnar VBS. You could also have a plaquette VBS. But if we put a JQ term with some staggered bonds, which I think is what you're asking about, then we actually get a strongly first order transition, and we never get to any deconfined critical point like that. And that's because the kind of fluctuations you can have, if you have staggered bond, you cannot have those U1 type of fluctuations that we can have when we have a columnar or a plaquette VBS.
Okay, well, any further questions? If not, please let's thank Anders for a very nice talk.